So with few exceptions, the discussion on moral enhancement is divided between two fundamental questions. The first question being whether moral enhancement is even possible through, say, pharmacological means. And under this first question, enhancement is understood, the actual enhancement is understood in either of two ways. Either the moral belief gets enhanced by, say, getting true, or one's moral behavior becomes enhanced by, say, comporting with pro-social attitudes or whatever they might be. And the second question is whether moral enhancement is ironic or paradoxical in the sense that doing so is itself immoral. And here, so if in fact belief enhancement or behavioral enhancement is possible, is it really me who is enhanced? Right? The question here might be, is enhancement somehow inauthentic in a morally objectionable way? Think of doping in sport, right? So my present project actually straddles both questions in the following way. So I wish to argue that moral enhancement is possible, not through drugs. It is possible, but can only be rational and thereby satisfy authenticity concerns by means of an epistemically humble action whereby the agent assents to the testimony of an epistemic authority. Now, to give the project some gravitational weight, I'm going to focus on belief enhancement. So the scaffolding of my project here is to, well, first begins with a basic understanding of cognition and try to apply that to moral cognition. With this basic understanding as a backdrop, I motivate what I refer to as the problem of the cognitive cul-de-sac. Very briefly, a very popular form of moral inquiry is reflective equilibrium, or RE. RE recommends that we begin our moral inquiry with a set of considered moral judgments. Those considered moral judgments are basic, and they have a feel of being correct. From these basic considered moral judgments, we look for a stronger and wider network of supporting beliefs. That is, we look for a wider coherence. Now, relying on an argument from Michael DePaul, the problem with the cognitive cul-de-sac is that the resulting network of beliefs is merely coherent. We have no reason for thinking that the beliefs are true. In particular, and DePaul's project is really focused on, we have no reason for thinking that the faculty that produced those beliefs is going to be reliable. And so from this, I'm going to try to construct an argument that the way out of the cul-de-sac is to rely on the testimony of a reliable authority. So basic, very basic, very brief outline of cognition. So recognition of things in the world is very varied. We know events in the past referred to as episodic memory. We have semantic knowledge, such as meanings of terms, for example, dog, cat, animal. We have visual knowledge, such as facial recognition. We know sequences of words, such as memorizing the divine office. Sequences of tunes, such as memorizing a musical piece. Who's memorized the divine office, right? There is maybe people who are in white here. We have physical knowledge, such as riding a bicycle, and cognitive skills, such as an air traffic controller, being able to look at a screen and recognizing immediately where the problematic areas for collision might occur. And we also recognize values, right? The basic neurological mechanisms for acquiring and retaining this knowledge is very roughly, of course, this different brain areas, but very roughly the same. So suppose there is a dog in my visual field while I am on my bicycle. Because I have been chased by dogs before, true, the visual presentation of a dog in my field attracts my attention for further processing. I now have activated various neurological nodes representing various concepts such as leashed versus unleashed, right? Distance from the dog, length of the leash, mean versus nice looking. This is called spreading activation. It allows me to know and interpret my environment. Within a few hundred milliseconds, I'm able to judge not merely that there is a dog in my visual field, but also whether I am safe, whose dog it is, etc. Now imagine how this processing would go or look differently had I never been chased by a dog before. Clearly a different spread of activation would occur such that different concepts represented by various neurological nodes or circuits would become activated. So upon seeing the dog, I might recognize instead what type of breed it is, do I have enough time to stop and pet the dog, etc. So the key point so far is that cognitive processing requires conceptual representation of the stimuli in my environment. I must have a representation of dog in order to recognize dogs as dogs. Furthermore, processing is governed not just in part by the bare stimuli hitting my retina in the case of perceptual knowledge, but is also governed by my overall goals, the attentional resources I have, and also prior learning. So prior learning here, think of the air traffic controller, has to look at multiple screens to acquire this level of perceptual expertise. So that can be involved there. Also, Abernathy and Ham give the example of a physician. So they say, am I here yet? No, not yet. They say a doctor who sees a patient who cannot move his left arm and leg thinks of the descriptive word hemiparesis, and the idea is associated with the diagnostic possibility of stroke. All right, so again, that's an example of learning where you see this perception, you have to pair this perception of left-sided weakness or left-sided inability with hemiparesis, and then you can infer, okay, there must have been a stroke involved. Someone with no contemporary medical knowledge might just as well infer left-sided weakness, infer from left-sided weakness that she should not have binge watched on Netflix the previous night. So you get the idea, right? You need some sort of background knowledge to pair some of the stimuli with the correct representation. So the example illustrates at least two points. First is that learning involves activation of neurological nodes representing different ideas. In this case, left-sided weakness needs to be associated with concept stroke. And second, in some cases, learning can be done easily with little repeated exposure. In other cases, you need multiple cases of exposure, as in the case of the air traffic controller. Moral intuitions apparently follow the basic similar pattern. Gui and colleagues in 2016 found evidence of neurological processing of moral versus non-moral stimuli as early as 80 to 150 milliseconds after exposure. The researchers noted the current study provides evidence of the neural underpinnings of moral intuition and indicates that moral intuition may occur before affective responses, unquote. So the idea here is that moral intuitions then are likely the result of processing that occurs prior to the threshold of consciousness. There is an immediate activation of various neurological nodes that represent the stimuli or situation as morally balanced. So how is this relevant? The relevance of these brief reflections on how cognition typically works will be seen when we consider Michael DePaul's argument for why reflective equilibrium is an insufficient method of moral inquiry. Now, reflective equilibrium, or RE, I'll just abbreviate it RE, itself is a rather intuitive method for acquiring beliefs. The first step in the method is to consider our moral judgments, filtering out the ones that might obviously not have epistemic status. How this filtering process works is not important. The point is that we begin our moral theorizing with beliefs about actions, the scope and strength of principles, or judgments about the moral character of persons. The next step is to construct a more coherent network of justification for one's beliefs. So the reason the starting moral judgments might not have the epistemic goods required on RE is because they might be whimsical, without grounds or reasons, or something else. Okay? So we have to build up a coherent network of beliefs, systematize them with reference to principles, and a broader theory. Now, along the way, the inquirer can make what Hazlitt refers to as adjustment decisions. And here you have two quotations from DePaul to illustrate what might be going on here. So, quote, if the person's judgment regarding a particular action runs counter to what is entailed for that case by a general principle she accepts, it is an open question whether the particular judgment or the general principle should be retained. Okay. Cases of conflict must be resolved individually. The inquirer must choose what to revise solely on the basis of what she is most strongly committed to on the basis of what seems to her to be most likely to be true. Okay, so what might be the problem here? It looks like these adjustment decisions are just as arbitrary, epistemically speaking, as one's intuitions were, right? They're based on what seems to me to be true. One is still making decisions on what beliefs to have based on what seems to the person as plausible, and this was supposedly the problem for intuitions, a problem that motivates acquiring a wider network of justification and support. But that further support is accumulated by what the agent thinks is plausible. Given the way in which moral intuitions are formed, we can't really expect anything more than that. Okay. All right, but what's so bad about this arbitrariness? And here I think DePaul gives a very illustrative example to show what might be going on here. He gives an example involving a fictitious character named Jay, a young, zealous, impressionable man who has a romantic view of warfare. War is good because it supplies a theater in which courage, honor, and bravery are realized. Jay has never been in a war, but he watches numerous movies that glorify the valor and triumph associated with it. And he has secondhand knowledge of actual combat from the stories he hears from the veterans at the local American Legion. One can see that on the spreading activation model, warfare is for joy, Jay. Warfare is not joyful. Warfare for Jay is associated with concepts such as courage, valor, defeat of bad guys, etc. Okay, that's the spreading activation explanation for why he has the associations he has. Now, if we suppose that Jay goes off to college and encounters arguments for very strict conditions for going to war, conditions that initially strike Jay as overly restrictive and pointless, Jay reads materials that rebut these stricter conditions. As a result, Jay's romantic view of warfare now takes on a deeper and more philosophically sustained support. Because Jay's starting intuition and preconception is that warfare is good, this starting intuition wins out in cases of conflict with stricter principles. Or at least we can imagine how this goes. We can imagine easily how this will go. Okay. If the professor who teaches Jay tries to dislodge Jay's commitment to his romantic views by showing him emotionally charged accounts of the collateral damage caused by war, Jay remains unmoved because his schemas representing warfare include valor and honor in the face of extreme sacrifice. Right, so he sees the sad costs of war, and he sees them as sad, but not as reasons against doing or engaging in the war. Right, okay. If he feels pity, he weighs that pity, right? He weighs that evidence against the good goals of the warfare in the first place. So again, the purpose of DePaul is to try to dress up an agent who doesn't have to change his beliefs when he starts getting more philosophically sustained support for them, right? DePaul is trying to motivate a case where we can easily imagine somebody who forms their beliefs around a starting presumption. And by the way, I have in the back of my mind some of the empirical evidence behind this that Jonathan Haidt and others have found that we start with our intuitions and reason gets hired out by a lawyer, like a lawyer, right, to defend the client, the initial intuitions. It's exactly what I think is going on here. So Jay's set of beliefs, right, Jay's set of beliefs have the following properties. He has a well-developed philosophical arguments against the non-romantic view of warfare and a host of positive arguments for his view. And lastly, we can imagine that Jay begins to develop a hermeneutic of suspicion of those who disagree with him, right? So that justifies to himself that he doesn't need to investigate the alternative views anymore. So clearly Jay's belief system regarding the ethics of warfare is dismal. But notice, however, that he has a widely coherent set of beliefs, right? Complete with counter-arguments and a hermeneutic of suspicion, the principal problem with Jay's belief system is Jay. Right? More precisely, Jay's faculty of moral judgment. He does not necessarily reason badly, he sees badly. One lesson learned from the example of Jay is that it is possible and quite frequent that we hold moral judgments that have the feel of being correct, are supported by a network of beliefs, and yet can be mostly false. If J tries to argue that his moral faculty is reliable, he may do this by pointing out his other judgments that he thinks are true, but clearly that's circular, right? That's assuming that your faculty has produced true beliefs previously. Now, I don't think skepticism follows. Skepticism, I think, follows, and I've argued that it does in my recent book, when one encounters peer disagreement. Why? Well, using one's own beliefs to argue that others are not epistemic peers can amount to an egotistical privilege in my own beliefs simply because they are my own. So peer disagreement, I've argued, applies skeptical pressure on one's belief that her faculties function well in forming that belief. Right? Okay. This is precisely the starting point for DePaul's solution to the problem. DePaul wants to say, just two quotations from DePaul here. DePaul's solution wants to say that we have to engage in moral inquiry in a way that refines our faculty of moral judgment, not just systematizes the outputs of that judgment. And he calls this balance and refinement. Okay? I call this method of balance and refinement balance in order to indicate the strong coherentist component that is carried over from reflective equilibrium, and refinement because the method deviates from earlier versions of coherentism in seeking to improve or develop the inquirer's faculty for making moral judgments. And again, the refinement part is accomplished by formative experiences. And the idea here is that formative experiences feel more as if they influence one's faculty of moral judgment, intuition, or perception, so that one sees situations in a different way. That's the problem with Jay, right? You show him movies of the sad cause. He doesn't see it. He doesn't resonate with the ethically salient details there. And feels drawn to make different moral judgments or accept different moral principles. Okay, so if you followed me to this point, you'll notice a pattern. We start with what appears plausible by our own lights. Right? Adjustment decisions are made by our own lights. Peer disagreement prompts me to think about, consciously reflect on the accuracy of my faculties in the domain in question or about the beliefs in question. And I might think to myself, right, if I follow DePaul's argument, I might think to myself, well, my faculties might need sharpening by way of formative experience. But which experience I choose to expose myself to is chosen by my own lights. Okay? So I'm not questioning whether there are such things as formative experiences that can refine our faculties. I'm suggesting that there is no agent who would choose to expose oneself to those experiences if she did not already think that they would be valuable to experience. And this is the problem of the cognitive cul-de-sac. It is the problem that in the setting of a putative peer disagreement, discharging this disagreement with reference to one's own coherent set of beliefs can be dogmatic, and given the way we form many of our moral judgments, such judgments might be deeply ensconced in our belief network simply because of repeated exposure and spreading activation. This is where I get excited. So, the way out. Okay. All right, so the way out. The problem here, one way to understand the problem. The problem here is not one of how to manage peer disagreement. Okay, so there is a problem of how to manage the peer disagreement. What do we do in response to peer disagreement? I'm not touching that literature. It's very interesting, yes? Peer disagreement merely brings into relief, right, the more fundamental problem of how to be epistemically virtuous in forming my beliefs. Okay? The problem with the cognitive cul-de-sac is a species of this more fundamental problem, in that I have no reason for thinking that my moral faculties are properly attuned to the moral goods at stake in an issue that I'm considering, certainly in setting of a peer disagreement. Coherence is not enough, and formative experience may work, but I would only choose experiences strictly based on my own ideological commitments. All right, think of a pro-choice person thinking to herself, I need to understand the pro-life view. Is she going to then stand on the sidewalk and protest outside of an abortion clinic? That's an example. Whether you think that's a formative experience or not, the idea of somebody choosing that has built into it a number of claims about whether that's going to really reveal that particular viewpoint. Is that really getting at the essence of that viewpoint? You can see how the problems of picking out what would count as a formative experience become very difficult. All right, so the problem is how should an epistemically virtuous agent proceed in light of this problem? So if I reflect on the spreading activation account of moral intuitions and how mere repeated activation can explain the strength of my convictions, the typical biases one is subject to, particularly when forming one's moral judgments, the tenuous epistemic comfort provided by coherence, my culturally situated epistemic position, and finally peer disagreement, if we consider all those things, then I should view with diffidence the reliability of my moral cognitive faculties. I have nowhere else to turn but to someone else's faculties. Whose? Well, here is where I want to stick my neck out and try to give an argument that we can understand the church, the church's teachings, as a quasi-faculty. Okay? So it's a faculty whose functions are distributed throughout time across persons and put to empirical test. More concretely stated, consider viewing encyclical letters, conclusions from councils, instructions from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, writings of theologians, and the application of those teachings put to empirical test by various saints throughout history, all as a quasi-cognitive faculty whose outputs are religious and moral judgments. Do we have reason for trusting those judgments? Linda Zygrzebski, in her book Epistemic Authority, argues that an agent can be justified in accepting the moral testimony of another. And she states, quote, "The authority of another person's or community's moral testimony for me is justified by my conscientious judgment that I'm more likely to form a true belief and avoid a false belief if I believe what the authority tells me than if I try to figure it out or try to figure out what to believe myself." In the setting of the cognitive cul-de-sac, one can conscientiously judge that accepting the belief from such and such authority will more likely give me a true belief than thinking about it myself. And Zygrzebski argues for this thesis on the starting assumption that one must trust her own epistemic faculties and the conscientious use she makes of them. Right? Before any inquiry starts, you have to trust your faculties at the very beginning of the inquiry, at some level. If so, quote, "Consistency requires," this is quoting Zygrzebski, "if so, consistency requires me to have the same basic trust in the epistemic faculties of other persons or communities whose general similarity to me I come to believe when I am conscientious." So if one treats like cases alike, one is rationally committed to thinking that other persons or communities are just as trustworthy in the moral domain as I am. My only twist to Zygrzebski's argument is that we don't have a strong reason for trusting our own epistemic faculties in the moral domain for the reasons already noted, but this just makes Zygrzebski's conclusion even stronger. Conscientious trust in another's faculty is even more warranted. Now, I've argued that we must rely on an epistemic authority to get out of our cognitive cul-de-sac, but why think that the church can function as that epistemic authority? Well, if one focuses on the church's teaching function as a quasi-cognitive faculty, the church's functions as, or the church's teachings, functions as a school for moral excellence, and we can see that their graduates are successful. Those who have lived by such teachings have led exemplary lives. Though a saint's actions might not be the most thing, the highest object of emulation, I'm thinking of the stylites, they can still be admired for the moral motivations that are informing them and the moral convictions that inform those actions. Following the psalmist's recommendation, "O taste and see that the Lord is good," the teachings of the church have been tested by various practitioners. So I have every reason to believe, moreover, that if I believe what the church teaches, those beliefs will survive conscientious reflection. Right, so that's a second property, right? I have every reason to believe that because they have. And finally, there are no non-circular arguments against such teachings. And none of these judgments require relying on my own moral judgments. These are epistemic criteria that I would apply to any kind of epistemic authority, no matter what the domain is. All right, well, how is this a moral enhancement? Well, the problem of the cognitive cul-de-sac was that someone could form a coherent network of beliefs around a starting belief that simply seems to one to be plausible. By performing an act of intellectual humility and assenting to the teachings of the magisterium, one's mind becomes perfected in virtue of three features. The first two are already mentioned, namely the acquisition of beliefs that likely survive critical reflection, because they have throughout history, and those beliefs have been tested and found to produce beautiful and morally exemplary lives. This third part is very experimental, and I'm thinking of Andy Clark's thesis of the extended cognition. The third is that by assenting to the teachings of the church, one acquires not just discrete beliefs here and there, but also the church's understanding of the moral life. It does so by extended cognition hypothesis, according to which certain cognitive functions, such as belief formation, not a belief, but belief formation, take place outside of one's brain. For example, calculators, smartphones, access to reliable encyclopedia entries. You can think of Wikipedia as performing the function of your hippocampus. You just can't retrieve it right away by your own. But you can retrieve it. I'm suggesting here that the person who assents to the teaching authority of the church acquires by extended cognition the understanding the church has about a flourishing life for the human person. More precisely, one does not inherit the whole constellation of beliefs, since I might never have read Aquinas' second part. Rather, I inherit the cognitive benefits of the processing that bequeath those beliefs. Okay, so I don't inherit the beliefs, but I inherit the cognitive benefits of the processing that went into those beliefs. For example, I may never think about the effects of charity as being joy, peace, and mercy, but if I were to explicitly believe in them, I inherit the benefits of the cognitive processing that went in to discover them. And that processing includes, among other things, the prayerful reflection of theologians under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. And I don't think there's a huge difference here with the disposition many of us have to believe in the discoveries of modern science. The point is that when confronted, by a challenge to a belief, I do have an epistemic right to say I don't specifically understand point P, but there are those who do, right? And I trust the cognitive processing that went into it. Okay, so I can be morally enhanced by acquiring, by extended cognition, the epistemic state of understanding the flourishing life in the way that the church does. Okay, so I do want to keep my talk on time, especially since I'm the last one. So I just want to run through a couple questions that I thought of, maybe some objections, and try to further refine what it is I'm trying to argue for. And then I'll conclude. So just a few questions. So first question might come up. There are so many objections to the church's teachings. How can one be expected to simply assent to them in an act of intellectual humility? All right, well, my first response is this discourse begins with acknowledging the problem of the cognitive cul-de-sac, right? So if my interlocutor agrees that she is in a cognitive cul-de-sac, and I've argued that she should, a coherent riposte to these teachings should not confer the epistemic comfort she hopes they provide, since a coherent set of beliefs could just as well be merely coherent. Furthermore, maybe it's just one of my fields is bioethics, and when I look at the church's teaching on bioethics, especially the dignity of the human person, I don't see anything objectionable about it. So, for example, do I have the quotation? No, I don't have. Quote, "The gift of life which God, the Creator and Father, has entrusted to man calls him to appreciate the inestimable value of what he has been given and to take responsibility for it." That's from Donum Vitae. Or try this one. Quote, "The dignity of a person must be recognized in every human being from conception to natural death. This fundamental principle expresses a great yes to human life and must be at the center of ethical reflection on biomedical research." And that's from Dignitas Personae. So I just see these moral commitments as being radically egalitarian, in terms of the dignity and worth of the human person. Okay. Second question, does not picking out who is a reliable authority done by the very faculty that I have reason for questioning? Would not the same reason for questioning my choice of genuine formative experiences recapitulate in the case of choosing a reliable authority? Here, the answer is a quick no, because the two sets of judgments are in different domains. So, for example, I may not trust my own ability to judge an argument concerning Goldbach's conjecture. Goldbach's conjecture is that every integer greater than 2 can be equal to the sum of 2 primes. So I might not be able to calculate that out, but I would certainly retain my ability to judge correctly a reliable authority on mathematics. But this deference to authority might invite a similar objection. My argument seems to justify being epistemically obsequious. Consider the character of Harriet in Emma, and this is this commentary comes from Zygzewski's book on authority. Harriet is, by all lights, an autonomous person, self-conscious and capable of thinking through issues at some level of sophistication, but she is not in circumstances that might incline her towards being servile. But when she is confronted with important decisions, she defers to Emma. Does my argument recommend the same obsequious behavior? Again, very briefly, there are crucial differences between what I am recommending and what Harriet does. My ideal epistemic agent performs an act of intellectual humility informed by conscientious reflection on the reliability of her faculties in the setting of peer disagreement. Harriet defers to Emma out of epistemic pusillanimity, or small-spiritedness, right? Second, my argument recommends intellectual honesty as one conscientiously reflects on the status of her coherent set of beliefs and the faculty that produce them, or faculties. Being epistemically obsequious is a vice because one defers to another without any discrimination or conscientious reflection. On the spreading activation model, how can one change his or her beliefs? And here is fairly important. Important point to know is that with more connections that are activated, the wider array of associations, so concretely stated, consider euthanasia. So what it seems to me, put my cards on the table, I don't think euthanasia is permissible. And to get that belief, what it is important to understand on that issue is the beauty of human life in all of its forms and from different angles. So reading lives of saints, both those who are martyred and those who are not, narratives of even Holocaust rescuers, the care of the Salesians for the youth, narratives of those who love and care for persons who are disabled, diseased, or mentally disabled, can all be ways in which our emotional sensitivities become attuned to the inherent irreplaceable worth of the person. What radio transmitters are to radio waves, narratives that celebrate the love for the human person are to the inherent dignity of the person. These stories should be promoted as soon as age appropriate, but importantly, they should not be looked at, but looked along. These narratives should be looked along, right? Not looked at. And the change in preposition here is meant to orient our moral reflection onto the beauty of the person who is loved, rescued, or cared for. All right, so the idea is by doing so, we hope to activate the right network of associations whereby one is better able to apprehend that it is impermissible to kill an innocent person. All right, final question, and then I'll sum up where I've been and take your questions. So the argument that we are in a cognitive cul-de-sac exploits an epistemic standard that we do not apply in any other domain of inquiry. For example, the scientific method has yielded wholly false views, but we do not discard it for that reason. Therefore, the standard is too strict, and therefore the cognitive cul-de-sac is not a serious problem. The response here is that the objection might apply to DePaul's thesis, according to which the method of reflective equilibrium is called into question by cases like J. But the problem with the cognitive cul-de-sac is that the resulting coherent network of beliefs has little epistemic status. So furthermore, the motivation for thinking one is in a cognitive cul-de-sac essentially depends on peer disagreement, right? The argument for being in a cognitive cul-de-sac cannot be generated, I don't think it can be generated, simply by reflecting on whether my faculties are reliable. divorced from any other evidence I might use for that reflection. Right? So I think we actually need a positive reason for thinking that these are questionable. To conclude, the argument in this paper can be summarized roughly as follows. It's not a syllogistic argument, but just kind of points that I think hang together. First, being in an epistemic cul-de-sac in a setting of peer disagreement gives one reason for doubting the reliability of one's moral faculties. We cannot use the outputs of those moral faculties to justify their reliability, the faculty's reliability, without circularity. And we cannot choose what counts as a formative experience without reference to the very coherent set of beliefs that we have reason for doubting. Restoring trust in our moral faculties can be accomplished by relying on another's faculty, whom we think satisfies certain objective epistemic standards. To the extent that the church can be understood as a faculty, right, throughout time and distributed across persons, the teachings of the magisterium as a faculty whose outputs will likely survive critical reflection and have been put to empirical test and found successful. We can restore rationality or trust in our moral faculties by relying on the authority of the magisterium, and so doing so, we enhance ourselves, belief-wise, in a way that preserves one's authenticity. This is because we assent to the church's teachings by an act of intellectual humility informed by epistemic standards that we ourselves can endorse. And this conclusion has the benefit of being entailed, I believe, by Scripture. So, quote, "If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit, for apart from me you can do nothing." Again, apart from me you can do nothing. Okay. John 15:5. "The true light which enlightens everyone was coming into the world." Again, John 1:9. "In your light shall we see light." Psalm 36. "And I have come as light into the world so that everyone who believes in me should not remain in the darkness." John 12:46. So I've given an argument that I think the way to become morally enhanced is not by taking drugs, but by assenting to the church's teachings that flow from this cognitive processing or the faculties distributed across time and throughout persons. I think that's a provocative enough conclusion, and I'll end there. Okay?
Thanks for the talk. It was awesome. I want to ask about the cognitive cul-de-sac. So I think the general argument for moral enhancement through sent to the church's teachings, actually, I think that's great. And I have two possible issues with the cognitive cul-de-sac component of it. So either it seems like it's too dire and then there isn't an escape through obedience to epistemic authority, or it seems not dire enough and then doesn't really strongly motivate obedience. So on the too dire side of things, it seems at times like the cognitive cul-de-sac is a problem that just afflicts human knowers as such. And now maybe I could move from a relatively small and constrained cul-de-sac to a relatively more spacious one, but I'm still just moving between cul-de-sacs. So I think we have this experience all the time of like being 18, limited by poorly formed and immature beliefs. You find a friend group, it seems like everyone here is super wise. 5 years later, you discover, well, they were also immature in their own way, and so on. Repeat the process. So is it just the case that when we enter into the church, we're just entering into a really, really big cul-de-sac? And what would really motivate saying these human knowers, as opposed to others, are in fact not in a cul-de-sac? So it might seem like it's too dire, there's not really an exit. The other problem is, maybe it's not really dire enough. So I'm not, I guess, immediately convinced that people can't or are totally unwilling to just experiment, right? Like, I might be in a certain way convinced of political opinions that inform my moral judgments about elections, but it seems totally intuitively plausible to me that someone might just throw themselves out there, go to a meeting of a group of Marxists or meet with a bunch of libertarians and just like, what do you guys think? Or read books that they don't have any priors for to process and just let them kind of system shock. That doesn't seem like that extreme, and it doesn't seem like I would need to place it within an already existing belief network. It seems just possible for me to just expose myself and then let whatever changes happen. And that may be a way to just at least continually shift the boundaries of the cul-de-sac experimentally, so I wouldn't need to pick an authority to get out. I could do it sort of with my own resources. So I guess those are the two questions. On the one hand, it seems like it might be too dire or not dire enough, and then how would you respond to this?
Yeah, that's very, very good. So thanks for that. So I think my response to that, it's not dire enough. I think my response has to import things that I didn't mention here, and that's the moral risk in being wrong. And I'm thinking in the back of my head, abortion, euthanasia, research that's destructive of human beings, you know, some of the bioethical stuff that I work on, where there's a moral risk in being wrong, and it seems like the argument that I have here that you might be in a cul-de-sac puts a lot of epistemic pressure on making sure you get it right. Okay? I like your bit on its let's say you assent to the teachings of the magisterium, you're just in a bigger cul-de-sac then, right? So is that a particular problem? And here I think I'm putting a little bit more emphasis on the deliberative process that's distributed throughout time and across cultures and in response to different cultures, right? So that I am putting some, and I don't have it quite worked out, how can I defend this? It's just, maybe it's an epistemic intuition I have that when you have a mechanism or a thing or community that's been deliberating about the moral life and the flourishing of a human person across time, not just across time, but in discussion with a number of different worldviews and ideas. And that particular epistemic community has survived that critical reflection. That seems to be a very powerful epistemic property of that community. And I would say, yeah, you might be in a bigger cul-de-sac, but it'd be an epistemically respectable one to be in.
So there are those out there who say we need to morally bio-enhance. So these are people who think we need to mess with the biology in order to get the right decision made. Now let's say we accept the church's position. And there are those out there who cannot achieve this higher level, discernment. Would you be in favor of morally bio-enhancing them according to the church's teachings, right? So because this is the argument that's being made, right? Exactly, right.
Let's put him in the ECT chamber.
This is the argument that's being made by like Celestu and Person, is that we know what morality is, and it happens to look just like what we have, and we need to morally bio-enhance it, right? Because they don't believe they're in an epistemic cul-de-sac, right? And so the trust of tradition, I'm all for it. Everything you said, I'm completely in agreement. Spelled out what I would mean by tradition about reflective thoughtfulness through time and history, and it makes good sense. But then there's that other piece that wants the technological enhancement. So you're talking about a kind of enhancement, a moral enhancement of trust. This would be a different kind, and that I wonder if that cashes out differently for you if we think about it in terms of the bio enhancement.
Yeah. So I didn't include this actually when I was first writing this paper, I was going to write that moral bio-enhancement was not particularly plausible. I didn't think that's the way to go. By bio-enhancement, maybe there's a pharmacological means, like increases in serotonin.
Yeah, pharmacological, or you can imagine nanomachines that might upregulate certain things, downregulate other things, so that you always choose, right?
Yeah. Sure, and I guess I'm sympathetic with Rob Sparrow's his response to Harris and Savulescu. Kind of put a kibosh on that part of my paper, and I started writing something different. But Sparrow has a really interesting line, and so the idea of Sparrow's position is, well, When you talk about moral enhancement, you're talking about making, first of all, believing the right thing in the right circumstances, being sensitive to the ethically salient details in a highly contextualized setting. The idea that I can control that pharmacologically is implausible to him. You do get associations between increases in serotonin and supposedly justice judgments, but my close read of those had to do with the trolley problem, and I didn't think that the conclusions followed there. So the first thing, I'm skeptical that pharmacological means can really capture a revision in one's belief that's sensitive to the ethically salient details that one is confronted with. But if there were, we could say, rephrase your question, if then, so if it were possible to do that, would I be in favor of doing that to get those beliefs in line with the church's teachings? And here, I lean towards saying I would not be in favor of doing that because of authenticity concerns. I would want the person to resonate either through stories or maybe, you can think of this CBT versus drug therapies, right? Most therapists will say you get CBT because that has the more enduring, respectful of the authenticity of the patient. And I would want to kind of export that intuition into this.
Thank you for a very thought-provoking talk. I was wondering in particular about the example of Jay. That really intrigued me.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess on one hand, imagine Jay gets his views on warfare from Thucydides, from Teddy Roosevelt. I imagine there's a large tradition of epistemic authorities that valorize warfare. So why are they a different kind of authority from the church? And then imagine Jay is instead fascinated by, say, medieval Europe. How is somebody who just has kind of a romantic notion of medieval Europe, say, different from somebody with a romantic notion of warfare? How does that avoid the kind of epistemic cul-de-sac that you were mentioning?
So to the first question, I'm not initially overwhelmed by the intuition that Teddy Roosevelt should be taken as an authority on warfare, right? Or Thucydides or something like that. I don't think that they should be taken as moral authorities on warfare. Now you might say, well, why? And then I argue that, well, they have the wrong view or something like that. But at the end of the day, I'm going to have to pick out, well, there's been a tradition of reflection on this that has survived critical reflection through different cultural situations and with respect to different viewpoints, and they come to a much more stricter condition on warfare. And I think that that's epistemically okay for me to respond to, you know, individual authorities that are culturally situated, temporally situated. I don't think that they would stand out as epistemic authorities. Your second question was,
what if somebody is, I guess, romantically attracted to the church as the church and will justify the Crusades, the Inquisition? I mean, you can imagine.
Oh,
sort of
right.
That.
Yeah.
And how is that different?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really good. My response is that some of those actions are incongruent with the church's teaching on the dignity of the human person, right? And it seems to me that the dignity of the human person has been one of the teachings that has survived critical reflection, and the Inquisition and all that is actually judged bad by the church's own teachings. That's my response to that. Do you want to reboot and try to?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say then it would seem like it's not so much the church qua church as epistemic authority that's the source of our ethics, but certain teachings of the church that we're placing higher than others, which would mean we're kind of making a prior judgment as to the church's which part of the church's authority is the most authoritative.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, that's very good. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to focus attention on the church's teaching function,
mm-hmm.
So the conclusions of councils, encyclical letters, instructions from the CDF. So in terms of the church's teaching function, we can take and let's take that and look at it, distribute it across time, across persons, and take that as a quasi-cognitive faculty with outputs. Can we trust the outputs? That I think we can. Church in terms of, I don't know, a priest or a bishop who does really bad things? No, because they're when they do really bad things, they aren't engaged in the teaching function of the church. Is that good enough to sort of specify where I'm locating the epistemic? I mean, it's an epistemic authority, right? So I'm looking at an epistemic authority that already I'm not going to be looking at the behavior here and there of bishops who make bad decisions, because they aren't giving me any beliefs. They aren't teaching me anything.
Thank you for your talk. Mm-hmm. My question is, for Catholics, there is a magisterium. However, for, let's say, other people who aren't Catholics, what agency would they refer to, since there are so many bodies that have been around for centuries, for example? And also, regarding what he said about Sidney's and Roosevelt, who would Jay refer to? Because he would only refer to someone who is an expert at war in order to change his opinion about war, his views about war.
Yeah, that's to take the last one first. That's the problem with Jay, right? Is that he would judge authority based on his own ideological commitments, and that's why I think that the epistemic cul-de-sac is a problem, right? Because he would is that, am I understanding your question correctly?
Well,
that
I was just wondering, who would he refer to? Because if he refers to Mahatma Gandhi, for example, who is nonviolent in order to change his opinion, he really wouldn't do that because that's outside of his view of someone who is supportive of war or supportive of this view. So who would he refer to? That would be able to change his mind, his values.
Yeah, so it sounds like the part of the question, if I say, well, you know, maybe he should look at Mahatma Gandhi, Augustine, you know, maybe some other traditions that have been around. But, you know, I'm not suggesting that Jay would convert. I mean, so my position doesn't require that Jay change his mind. What I'm suggesting is that there is an epistemic authority that Jay could trust. And that epistemic authority would be an intellectual tradition that is distributed across time, et cetera, et cetera. What he would choose, or what authority he would choose to go to, I would recommend to Jay that he choose an epistemic authority that's been around a while and has thought about warfare, and those who have lived by those teachings have led exemplary lives. That's what I'd say to Jay. Whether Jay converts or not is not, I don't need a say that he will convert if he does this. And that's not part of my position. Now, I'm sorry, you had a first question on that.
For Catholics, we have the magisterium office.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's right. So, I used to be Orthodox. Before that, I was evangelical Protestant. Before that, I was what Norman Kretzmann would refer to as an alpha theist. Just a bare theist, right? God exists. So I guess what in my conversions, what I've seen is especially my conversion to Orthodoxy, is the relevance of a longstanding tradition that has reflected on things. When you look at the moral teachings across the different religions, you do find an enormous commonality. I think Lewis's Abolition of Man, towards the last section, he kind of goes through that there's a high similarity of teachings across all the religions, not just within Christendom. That strikes me as being enormously authoritative. And so even if somebody is not a Catholic, they could still defer to a long-standing tradition and come to what I would believe to be epistemically respectable beliefs about the human person.
I have, I guess, a follow-up question about taking drugs. So let's say you answered Professor's question before about, you know, a person takes drugs and is then kind of shoehorned into the magisterium to use on things, and you kind of had some questions or qualms about the authenticity of that person. What if, let's say, I had assented to the teachings of the magisterium, but I still have a lot of moral calculations to do, right? Because the church gives a lot of guidance, but still oftentimes there's not like a clearly defined path to take. So let's say, for example, I've pledged obedience, and my superior tells me to basically keep hush some kind of wrongdoing, right? Now, depending on what the wrongdoing is and the severity of it, you know, it might be right for me to, you know, obey, or it might be right for me to disobey and to tell people, right? But judging that is oftentimes a difficult thing. So let's say that there was a drug that I could take that would basically, so it wouldn't be, I think, diluting my authenticity at all, because I want to be able to make this moral calculation correctly. Would I be able to ethically take that drug that would make me a better moral calculating agent, I guess?
I find it hard to answer that question because I don't think there is a drug that would do that to the brain. Let's just play around, okay? So I don't want to just shut down a question without having fun with it. All right, so let's say there is a drug out there that would help me discern, would I be somehow violating my authenticity? First of all, I think you're right, if I want to take this drug, right? That looks analogous to assenting to the teachings of the magisterium, right? Even though it's like, so I want to assent to the teachings of the magisterium, I want to take this drug, right? So there's no authenticity concerns. Why can't I take the drug? Supposing there is a drug out there that would do this, there has to be a mechanism of action, right? And I would say, okay, you can take it on this one occasion, but the mechanism of action, right, getting back to the CBT, there's a mechanism of action for CBT. Actually, there was a study done on OCD patients, 12-week CBT on OCD patients showed a higher level of frontal cortex activity at the end of the therapy, showing a higher level of being able to be okay and not control everything around them and to keep the amygdala in check. So I would say that's still, right, even though you're getting at the neurobiology of decision-making and sensitivity, I would still say it would be better to have this on your own, so to speak, right, and not via a drug. But I would say it's permissible to take the drug. Let me stick my neck out. What would follow from that, right? Right. So I say it's okay to take the drug to get your beliefs in line with the church's teaching if there were a drug that would be effective in this regard. What happens to my thesis?
Not sure. Is
my argument that the magisterium cannot function as an epistemic authority and get us out of our cognitive cul-de-sac? Does that follow?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It doesn't do any damage to
our environment. Okay, all right. So I was wondering where you might be going. Okay, all right, so just checking. Okay, this is fun.
Just a quick thought on his question.
Okay, yeah.
It's not clear when you're talking about the drug cases. If you're talking about someone who's going from a deficiency to like a neurotypical state, right? Or someone who's going from neurotypical to enhancing. Because that's when it comes to judgments.
Yeah.
You know, we know that, say, depression and anger can be very closely correlated. We know that people who are angry make all sorts of false judgments. They see slights that aren't there, like conspiracy theories. And, you know, if you can give them a drug that will help work their depression and everything, their judgments can clear up a lot. So that's just one question. If your criticism of the drugs is for moving from deficiency to normal or... if it includes that,
I interpreted Brian's question, given the context, given the example he gave, that this is a very highly refined level of discernment that's required in that situation. So I was understanding it to be, you know, if I needed this drug to get me from a normal to an enhanced level of discernment. Yeah.
My real question.
Okay.
It's,
right.
It's just a question about who the authority is that I'm putting my trust in. So as I understand Aquinas' teaching on faith, and I'm sure if I'm wrong, corrected, but you know, the formal object of faith is God revealing, and I believe the teachings of the church, because I believe they're revealed by God. You know, that I'm not directly just believing in the teachings of the church because of their self-evidence or something. And you know, I think this is sort of independently plausible. And so I'm wondering if maybe, even when it comes to the magisterium, if at least when grace is involved and there's a kind of certainty in the teachings of the church, if the primary epistemic trust is actually in God himself.
Yeah. Now, this is very good. So are you familiar with Alvin Plantinga's Warranted Christian Belief? Yeah. So, you know, in that book, he talks about the sensus divinitatis. And the sensus divinitatis is the cognitive faculty that we have. But he also talks about the internal instigation of the Holy Spirit and how the internal instigation of the Holy Spirit sort of moves, or the sensus divinitatis is sort of the antenna that receives the signals from the internal instigation of the Holy Spirit. And so if we kind of export that kind of model that the church in her teachings distributed across time, across theologians who are prayerfully reflecting on these things, the Holy Spirit is sort of like that. It's analogous to Plantinga's explanation for how the sensus divinitatis can be refined and deliver the outputs that are accurate religious judgments. I just want to kind of export that and apply them to the moral sphere, right? So, more concretely stated, if God exists and God wants to ensure that we live flourishing lives, we have every reason to think that God is going to give us guidance, right? And so I'm going to have every reason for thinking that the magisterium is an expression of the Holy Spirit's mind, right? So yeah, if your question was, am I assenting to a proposition? No. You're assenting to trusting God, who has distributed throughout time and across persons a deposit of truths that contribute to human flourishing if they're followed.
I'm not sure that so I'm asking kind of a question of clarification, mm-hmm. but maybe it would turn into an objection. I'm not sure if I have an objection or just. It's on that level. One of the I guess concerns that I had as I was leaving, I'm very sympathetic to the argument about relying on an epistemic authority. Okay, that's I think a reasonable thing to do, and it's permitted, you know, certainly morally permitted to do. I think it needs some, there needs to be some warrant for it at some point. But there's also the phenomenon, I mean, I think we could say, what are we doing in the case of an act of faith in, you know, the church's teaching as, like, this has been divinely revealed? I think Justin was just raising a good question there. There would be a disagreement between, you might say, traditional Thomas and Plantinga on exactly what's involved in making that, you know, making that act, or what's the object of that. I think, the Thomists would want to probably emphasize something in the supernatural order there that Plantinga would perhaps not quite fully account for. I'm not an expert in Plantinga, but anyway, just saying, let's set that aside for a moment and look at the question of what happens when someone is able to critique their own tradition from within, which seems to me to be an important dimension of the tradition, and also what gets a tradition going if we take out this question of divine revelation as necessary. Because if you're just a philosopher, if you're Aristotle and you're reflecting on this, or you're Thomas Aquinas and you're reflecting on something, not drawing on divine revelation, and you're just trying to puzzle through, well, what's the right thing to do in terms of the natural law, for example, in a particular case. Mm-hmm. Someone in our own tradition is able to stand up and say, you know what, this is generally accepted in our society and even in my own moral tradition, but I think it's wrong, and I'm going to give an argument for why I think it's wrong. I mean, we have kind of some great heroes in, you might say, in the United States. We'd say Martin Luther King was able to do this. And we praise him for that, precisely for being able to critique the tradition from within. I mean, his letter from a Birmingham jail is written to clergymen. So he's, as a clergyman, maybe in a way, making this claim. Although, anyway, maybe that's confusing the issue about revelation or not. But this is my question, is getting the tradition going and critique from within, and how to understand that in your picture.
Yeah, good. Yeah, well, first, I mean, my initial thought to clarify is I do think that critique from within would be part of the deliberative, intersubjective deliberative process that actually contributes to the reliability of the faculty distributed across time. So I'm assuming that there is critical engagement. Now you might say, well, you know, is it just the numbers? Like I think, what was it, Athanasius, St. Hilary, and another, there were the only three bishops that held to orthodoxy there. I would have to probably explain why that their beliefs were accepted by divine intervention. But if we're excising that out of that question, My view of the tradition is that it would most certainly involve critical reflection on its own judgments throughout time. How does a tradition get going in the first place? That's a permutation of the question, or is that...
No, I mean, I think that's part of the question is, you know, can we just take it as given that there are varying traditions, or there's only really one tradition, and then various pretenders, false pretenders, or is it possible to, I mean, it seems like there are kind of origins to moral schools of thought.
Yeah.
And those people had to do something. Seems like, in a certain way, we'd say, well, Aquinas is a genius. I mean, I certainly feel that way. When I read him, it's like, well, I just kind of want to get in his mind and think with him.
Yeah.
So I'm learning not just from the conclusions, but I'm also learning by the habit of mind that he had and the way he's... And I actually, you know, it's not just that there's a tradition, but it, I think he somehow was right or something. Like it seems to me that there's some way that I'm actually able to, with my mind, I may not be able to come up with the answer, but I may be able to kind of recognize the truth of the matter, in a stronger sense than it sounded to me like you were presenting with the kind of cognitive cul-de-sac. I guess that's my question.
Yeah. So, I don't know where to begin in answering, other than just giving in. You know, looking at historical actual cases of intellectual traditions that have developed and look at, you know, what are the features that would constitute the beginning of an intellectual tradition. With respect to, well, let me pause there. Where do you want to go with an objection so far? So I do grant that within a particular intellectual tradition, you're going to have intersubjective exchanges and conscientious reflection, which will involve a critique from within, as you say. What granting that, does anything follow from that?
No,
yeah.
Think,
okay.
No, I think that's that. My concern or the question that I have is: to what degree is an individual actually able to get some traction on making a moral judgment and not just relying on an epistemic authority, being able to say, yes, okay, actually this is true and I'm not just convincing myself of it. I mean, we understand the case of Jay, who doesn't really search for the truth in the fullest sense because he's got other concerns there, but it seems like someone can... Yeah, yes.
Is that a microphone?
So I think you're asking about faith and reason, basically. You know, it's just a leap of faith that then leaves behind rational reflection, or the interface of philosophy and theology.
Yeah.
Faith and reason require that these two disciplines have their own methodological principles. So faith will indeed rely on the witness of the church and the community of the church. But philosophy has its own independent principles, just principles of logic or something like that.
Yeah.
In the absence of this independence, faith becomes cannot be distinguished from superstition anymore. Right? So you have to be to give a rational account
yeah.
of the faith that appeals to principles that are already derived from the faith.
Yeah.
So, for example, the church will appeal to secular science, neuroscience, or whatever it might be, to distinguish a true miracle from, you know, a deception, let's say. In Lourdes, you have atheists, medical doctors looking at these alleged miracles, and
yeah.
some turn out to be right.
Yeah, okay. Right, so what I have to say there, or the first thing that first thought that comes to mind is that, you know, in part of my argument is I want to, I don't know if this is a particular virtue of the argument, but I want to make reference to epistemic standards that would be inter-theoretical, right? Somebody could grant me that when we look at epistemic authorities, they have these properties, such as, and I try to lay out the particular epistemic criteria that we look for in adjudicating an epistemic authority. So why someone would want to assent to that particular authority would have to be on the person's own conscientious reflection on the reliability of their faculties in the setting of peer disagreement, maybe even disagreement with that particular intellectual tradition. And that should prompt them to reflect further and look at the reliability of the deliberative process that the tradition went through versus their own situated deliberation. So that seems to be where I do want to say that there would be reasons to assent to the epistemic authority of the magisterium. It wouldn't be strictly by faith. I mean.
In line with that, if you could just clarify,
mm-hmm.
right, if you think that this epistemic authority of the church's teaching would actually hold without God, and isn't this just an instrumental usage of the church's teachings and something of an evolutionary gathering over time of these teachings? Because if you look at saints, you cannot take out of their behavior, their relationship with God, and that moral, how can you set apart their relationship with God from their actions?
So, I'm not doing that, right? So I'm not dividing up, sort of setting out or dividing up their the role of God and their actions. I'm trying to view this through the lens of Jay, right? So let's suppose Jay doesn't have any beliefs in God or whatsoever. What's going to get him to consider an epistemic authority? Well, I have to trot out and focus attention on the epistemic criteria. But in outlining the epistemic criteria, I'm not ruling out the idea that God exists or that God or the Holy Spirit is, I mean, get a similar question than what was asked before, that the Holy Spirit is guiding the church and guiding these saints. I mean, I think I don't want to divide that up at all. Yeah.
Thanks. So I think a lot of this discussion has, to me, it can be summed up in terms of, like, the need for some way to ground this in something that, like, corresponds to reality. Because a couple of your arguments for trusting the church have been like the saints have lived very exemplary lives, and the church's teachings have held up in a process of rational deliberation. But it seems like in both of those cases, you're sort of bringing in moral judgments already made in order to say that these saints live extraordinary lives, as opposed to, like, you know, terrible lives that were just devoted to principles that they thought were right but were actually wrong.
Maybe foolish lives.
Yeah, or with regard to the holding up to deliberation line, like a utilitarian could say, well, human dignity actually doesn't hold up to rational argument. And in order to judge that it does, you need to assess the claims of utilitarians versus of Catholics and say that the Catholics are right about that. And that involves an exercise of moral judgment. So it feels like there's just a piece missing that is going to ground this in reality. And I'm wondering if that might be like an assessment of the historical claims of the church, that Christ actually lived, that he actually rose from the dead and established the church, and it gets its authority from that. Is that sort of part of this? Is that going to ground it?
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, that could. I don't know how much I would... Well, the quick answer to your question, yes, that could. Now, a very interesting line that, you know, with the utilitarians versus the Catholics on intrinsic dignity, it seems like we're stuck in an argument. That's exactly, maybe this goes back to Carl's question, you know, it's just we're in a bigger cul-de-sac, so to speak. But there, I would again, in, like I responded to Carl's question, is make reference to the moral risk in being wrong on cases of killing, in particular, abortion, euthanasia, and all that. Now one piece that I haven't mentioned that I do think is relevant is there are some arguments out there that on naturalism you don't have a reason for trusting your moral faculties at all. And so I do think that there is a role for that argument to play in giving reasons for really assenting to a supernatural tradition. So I wouldn't leave out some of the natural theology moves that you're making, but I do think that it's crucial to focus also on, say, an evolutionary argument against naturalism as part of a more broader defense of what I'm trying to get at.